Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Marcia James, Anne Ball, and Bruce Alpert. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will report on Zachary Taylor in our series on America's Presidents. But first, Britain wants to improve trade relations with African nations after it leaves the European Union. Some people have called the planned project Empire 2.0 because many African countries are former British colonies. However, some experts believe Britain's attempt to build on past links with those African nations could meet resistance. They say exporters face years of uncertainty over future trading relations with Britain. British officials say leaving the EU will permit Britain to go global and freely trade with the rest of the world. Britain claims the EU has prevented many of its trading goals. Kwasi Kwarteng is a British lawmaker whose family is from a country that once was a British colony. He says that many people in former colonies have both good and bad memories of British rule.
My own family is from West Africa, Ghana, which is a Commonwealth country, was a former colony. And people have very mixed memories of the empire. So to try and relive that past, I think, is a completely ridiculous and forlorn exercise.
Britain's history on the African continent includes many conflicts. One example was the Mau Mau Uprising, a rebellion that took place in Kenya in the 1950s. But Kwarteng believes the old links established during British rule will aid new trade deals.
There's a vast world out there, nearly 80% of global GDP, which is outside the EU. And a lot of that GDP is taken up by Commonwealth countries.
Critics, however, note that almost half of British exports go to the European Union. Less than 10% of British exports go to Africa. To increase trade, Britain wants quick trade deals with developing countries. But Matt Grady, with the fair trade organization Tradecraft, says African nations should negotiate carefully with Britain or the UK. He says that African countries have indicated that their priorities are regional integration and cooperation. So now is not really the time for the UK to be trying to negotiate deals with African countries that will undermine those priorities. Grady adds that decisions are being made now for 2 years down the line on uncertain conditions. This week, the head of the African, Caribbean, and Pacific Group of States called for a delay in talks. Patrick Gomez said that a free trade deal with Britain should be delayed until at least 6 years after Britain's exit from the EU.
Color could be considered a visual language. It can influence thinking and affect how humans act. Red can lead to anger. Green can help create calm. Color can cause happy feelings, as well as sad. Some colors even cause a feeling of hunger. So how does color contribute to a person's sense of identity and human social interaction? Student designers at the Maryland Institute College of Art, MICA, in Baltimore, Maryland, explored those questions recently at an annual fashion show. This year's show was called Human, spelled H-U-E-M-A-N. The name combines hue, another word for color, with man as in human. Brianna Arrington was one of the show's organizers. The name for the show reflects the way that we connect, and it speaks to color playing a big part in our civil existence, she said. More than 20 designers created the ready-to-wear clothing exhibit.
Designer Grayson Gross calls her clothing line Queens. She used bold colors for each model to create sharply individual silhouettes.
My line is called Queens, and it's about empowering queer people by putting them in clothes that were regal and royal-looking. Like, I put one of my models in gold because I thought it really emphasized their skin tone and the way they view themselves.
Gross said she wanted each model's magic to come off. The second-year MICA student says she used only queer models and identifies herself that way as well. She said she is gender fluid. She says her fashion designs celebrate queer people all over the world.
I really wanted to do something that talked about identity as it relates to my community. And color is a really strong communicator about the person who's wearing those colors. It says something about, you know, how soft or bold or interesting they are.
Student designer Calvin Chang's fashions centered on his support for gender equality. Born in Taiwan, Chang was taught that responsibility belongs to men. He created his line, Power and Elegance, to show that women are powerful.
This line is about breaking the stereotype of what woman's power suit should be.
Chang used different materials, prints, and patterns in his fashion to show just how powerful women's clothing can be. He uses exciting colors. He says people can express emotion through color.
I use like strong red, dark green. I use really bright yellow. I use really cold blue. Like, I explore different colors that's on the model that I know, I understand their mood. It actually all represents my model's personality.
Tension Underneath is a futuristic line designed by third-year students Chelsea Lozano and Gina Fulton. The designers used sporty patterns, flowy fabric, and even armor. They say their clothes are designed for underrepresented groups of people.
What we focus on our line is how people around this world can generally aggressive things happening to them throughout their life and how they have to adapt to that, you know, and still exist in society and, like, progress through these problems.
Gina Fulton says the armor represents a mix of self-defense, color, and versatility to protect the wearer's emotions in oppressive environments. Each piece expresses a different emotion.
With our first designs, it was more of a protective or defensive approach to it, which is why we had the armor that kind of like shielded the self. And later on, we focused more on like the involvement of human technology and our interconnected growth, which is why the final design was more of like clear, had more earthy colors to it, had a lot of like green and blue hues, because we wanted to signify, you know, kind of like the free-flowing form of nature and how man is also part of nature, and we use technology in a lot of these different ways.
Other MICA students used unusual objects in their designs. Colorful traffic equipment, foam, plastic, and computers helped create many pieces at the Human Show. I'm Marcia James.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
Researchers may have found an unusual way to reduce plastic pollution, one bite at a time. It turns out that the common waxworm can eat plastic. Also known as the Galleria melanella, these worms may help reduce the waste caused by plastic bags. Each year, 1 trillion plastic bags are used around the world. They are made from polyethylene, one of the strongest kinds of plastic. The waxworm is the larvae or young form of an insect called the greater wax moth. These kinds of worms are also called caterpillars. Federica Bertocchini is with the Institute of Biomedicine and Biotechnology of Cantabria in Spain. She says researchers found that the larvae of the Galleria melanella are able to biodegrade the plastic bags. To biodegrade means to break down by natural processes or bacteria.
They discovered this by accident, Bertocchini explains. She says the plastic bags holding the wax worms became riddled with holes. In other words, the bags had holes all over them when the worms were inside. Bertocchini, a beekeeper, says she made the chance discovery after removing the worms from beehives, where they live. She put the worms in a plastic shopping bag, which became full of holes. Bertocchini worked with other researchers from the Spanish National Research Council and Britain's University of Cambridge's Department of Biochemistry. She carried out timed experiments on the worms. She says the worms can do damage to a plastic bag in less than an hour. When 100 worms were placed in a normal British plastic shopping bag, the holes began to appear in just 40 minutes. After 12 hours, researchers saw an obvious reduction in plastic mass.
They say a single enzyme produced by the worm is responsible for the chemical process that breaks down the plastic. They also found that the worms turned the polyethylene into a different organic compound called ethylene glycol. It is used in making polyester fibers as well as antifreeze for vehicles. It is not clear if the worms produce enough for commercial use. Plastic is not the natural food for the waxworm, but the researchers say that since they lay their eggs in beehives, the larvae feed on beeswax. Wax is a polymer, a sort of natural plastic that has a chemical structure that is not dissimilar to polyethylene, Bertocchini says.
Researchers say they still need to better understand how wax is digested or processed in the worm. Finding that out could lead to a solution for dealing with plastic waste. Bertocchini says they are planning to use this research to find a way to get rid of plastic waste. She says they are working towards a solution to save our oceans, rivers, and all the environment from the problems of plastic waste.
But, she adds, we should not throw polyethylene into the environment just because we now know how to biodegrade it. The study was published in the journal Current Biology. I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm Bruce Salpert.
Been listening to VOA Learning English. For more stories, photos, and videos, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Up next, Kelly Jean Kelly presents the next part in our series on America's Presidents.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Zachary Taylor, the 12th president. He took office in 1849. Taylor had some things in common with earlier presidents. Like six others before him, he was born in Virginia. Like George Washington and Andrew Jackson, Taylor was a war hero. And, like William Henry Harrison, he died in office. But Taylor brought at least one special trait to the presidency. Although he was officially elected as a member of the Whig Party, Taylor considered himself an independent. When Zachary Taylor was a baby, his family left Virginia. They moved west to a tobacco plantation in Kentucky. There, the Taylors were financially successful. By the time Zachary was a young man, his family owned a number of enslaved people and over 4,000 hectares of land. Taylor took possession of some of his family's land. He also had cotton plantations in the southern states of Mississippi and Louisiana. he too depended on enslaved people to do most of the work. But Taylor was unlike many wealthy farmers in the South. He had always wanted to be a soldier. When Taylor was 24 years old, he became an officer in the U.S. Army. Shortly after, he married Margaret Smith. In time, they had 5 daughters and 1 son. But Taylor directed most of his attention to his military career. For about 20 years, he tried to keep peace between Native American tribes and white Americans. Sometimes the job meant leading attacks against Native Americans. At times, it meant defending their lands from white settlers. In either case, his public standing as a good soldier grew. His troops called him Old Rough and Ready because he was willing to fight and suffer alongside them. Then, in the Mexican-American War of the 1840s, Taylor became really famous. He led U.S. troops to victory in several major battles, including ones at Monterrey and Buena Vista. In a well-known story, the powerful Mexican general Santa Anna surrounded Taylor and his small number of troops. Santa Anna sent a message demanding that they surrender. Taylor reportedly said, "Tell him to go to hell." The two sides clashed the next morning. Santa Anna had about 3 times the men that Taylor had. Yet, by late that day, Taylor's soldiers had defeated Santa Anna's. Taylor's success as a general helped the United States win the war against Mexico. In the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, Mexico agreed to give up claims to or sell to the U.S. more than 1.3 million kilometers of its lands, including what are now the states of Texas and California. But the new lands almost immediately caused problems. At the time of the next U.S. presidential election, public opinion in the country was severely divided. The issue was whether to permit slavery in the new lands won at the end of the war with Mexico. In general, Northerners opposed expanding slavery. In general, Southerners supported it. To appeal to both these groups, the major parties at the time looked to Taylor to be their candidate for president. The Democrats and the Whigs reasoned that Taylor was already well-known and well-liked. Historian Michael Holt said, in 1848, Taylor was the most popular man in America. But Taylor was not really political. He called himself an independent. He shared some beliefs with both major parties at the time. But mostly, he wanted to keep the nation together. In the end, he agreed to be the candidate of the Whig Party. During the campaign, he did not take a stand on any of the major issues. His fame as a military general carried him into the White House. The truth was that Taylor did have an opinion on slavery. He did not want to expand it, especially in areas that did not support cotton or sugar farms. So, once in office, he proposed a change to the rules about how new territories would become states. The change would let white American male settlers in California and New Mexico decide whether they wanted slavery. Then those areas could enter the Union immediately as states. Taylor aimed to quiet the debate about slavery, but his idea angered almost everybody. Some U.S. lawmakers believed the president had cut them out of the decision. Northerners said Taylor's proposal did not go far enough. It did not solve some of the other issues related to slavery. And Southerners realized that settlers in California and New Mexico would almost surely reject slavery and give free states a majority in Congress. In one dramatic incident, some South Carolina officials called a meeting to discuss withdrawing from the Union. In answer, Taylor threatened to hang them. But before Taylor or his idea could get too far, the president became sick. The story is that he attended outdoor celebrations to mark the nation's birthday, July 4th. Then he went for a walk. The weather was very hot. To cool off, Taylor ate uncooked fruit and drank iced milk. That night, he told others about pain in his stomach. 5 days later, he was dead. His doctor wrote that Taylor died of cholera morbus, a general term for severe digestive problems. A few people thought he might have been poisoned. The suspicion remained until 1991, when medical officials examined Taylor's remains. They confirmed that he died of natural causes. A more recent study offers more details. Jane McHugh and Philip A. Makoviak say that Taylor was a victim of the same problem that killed Presidents William Henry Harrison and James Polk: dirty water in the White House. Taylor's death, while unfortunate, did not cause a political crisis. John Tyler had already established the rule that if a president dies in office, the vice president becomes president. But Taylor's death did likely change the direction of history. His replacement, Millard Fillmore, did not try to hold the Union together by force. Instead, he joined with politicians who wanted to compromise on the issue. The compromise legislation delayed but did not really settle the debate. In time, the division between North and South led to the American Civil War. And members of Taylor's own family became linked to the states that withdrew from the Union. One of his daughters had married Jefferson Davis, who became the president of the Confederacy. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.